father. Simon had noticed her because she looked a little like his first wife, although she was not as beautiful. When he now heard that there was kinship between them, he went over and greeted Ingeborg and sat down to talk to her. After a while, the dancing broke up. The older folk sat down to drink, but the younger ones continued to sing and frolic out on the floor. Erland came over to the fireplace along with several elderly gentlemen, but he was still absent-mindedly leading Fru Suniva by the hand. The men sat down near the fire, but there was no room for Suniva, so she stood in front of Erland and ate the walnuts he cracked in his hands for her.
"You're an unchivalrous man, Erland," she said suddenly. "There you sit, while I have to stand."
"Then sit down," said Erland with a laugh, pulling her down onto his lap. She struggled against him, laughing and shouting to his wife to come and see how her husband was treating her.
"Erland just does that to be kind," replied Kristen, laughing too. "My cat can't rub against his leg without him picking her up and putting her in his lap."
Erland and Fru Suniva remained sitting there as before, feigning nonchalance, but they had both turned crimson. He held his arm lightly around her, as if he hardly noticed she was sitting there, while he and the men talked about the enmity between Erling Vidkunsson and Chancellor Paul, which was so much on everyone's mind. Erland said that Paul Bardsson had displayed his attitude toward Erling in quite a womanish way, as they could judge for themselves. "Last summer, a young country boy had come to the gathering of the chieftains to offer his services to the king. Now, this poor boy from Vors was so eager to learn courtly customs and manners that he tried to embellish his speech with Swedish words. It was French back when I was young, but today it's Swedish. So one day the boy asked someone how to say tråkig, which happens to mean boring in Norwegian. Sir Paul hears this and says, 'Tråkig, my friend, that's what Sir Erling's wife, Fru Elin, is.' The boy now thinks this means beautiful or noble, because that's what she is, and apparently the poor fellow hadn't had much opportunity to hear the woman talk. But one day Erling meets him on the stairs outside the hall, and he stops and speaks kindly to the youth, asking him whether he liked being in Nidaros and such things, and then he tells him to give his greetings to his father. The boy thanks him and says it will please his father greatly when he returns home with greetings from you, kind sir, and your boring wife. Whereupon Erling slaps him in the face so the boy tumbles backwards down 3 or 4 steps until a servant catches him in his arms. Now there's a great commotion, people come running, and the matter is finally cleared up. Erling was furious at being made a laughingstock, but he feigned indifference. And the only response from the chancellor was that he laughed and said he should have explained that tråkig was what the regent was. Then the boy couldn't have misunderstood." Everyone agreed that such behavior on the part of the chancellor was undignified, but all of them laughed a great deal. Simon listened in silence, sitting with his chin resting on his hand. He thought this was a peculiar way for Erland to show his friendship for Erling Vidkunsson. The story made it quite clear that Erling must be a little unbalanced if he could believe that a youth, freshly arrived from the countryside, would dare stand on the stairs to the king's palace and ridicule him to his face. Erland could hardly be expected to remember Simon's former relationship as the brother-in-law of Fru Elin and Sir Erling. "What are you thinking about, Kristen?" he asked. She was sitting quietly, her back straight, with her hands crossed on her lap. She replied, "Right now I'm thinking about Margaret." Late that night, as Erland and Simon were tending to a chore out in the courtyard, they scared off a couple standing behind the corner of the house. The nights were as light as day, and Simon recognized Håkon of Gimsar and Margaret Erland's daughter. Erland stared after them. He was quite sober, and the other man could see that he wasn't pleased. But Erland said, as if in excuse, that the two had known each other since childhood, and they had always teased each other. Simon thought that even if this meant nothing, it was still a shame for Håkon's young wife, Ingeborg.
The next day, young Håkon came over to Nikolasgard on an errand, and he asked for Margit. Then Erlend furiously exclaimed, "My daughter is not Margit to you. And if you didn't say everything you wanted to say yesterday, then you'll have to forget about telling it to her." Håkon shrugged his shoulders, but when he left, he asked them to give his greetings to Margareta. The people from Husaby stayed in Nidaros for the Ting, but Simon took little pleasure in this. Erlend was often bad-tempered when he stayed at his estate in town, because Gunnulf had granted the hospital, which stood on the other side of the orchard, the right to use any of the buildings that faced in its direction, and also rights to part of the garden. Erlend wanted to buy these rights back from the hospital. He didn't like seeing the patients in the garden or courtyard. Many of them were also hideous in appearance, and he was afraid they would infect his children. But he couldn't reach an agreement with the monks who were in charge of the hospital. And there was Margaret Erland's daughter. Simon knew that people gossiped about her a good deal, and that Kristen took this to heart, but her father seemed not to care. Erland seemed certain that he could protect his maiden, and that the talk meant nothing. And yet he said to Simon one day that Klung Arason would like to marry his daughter, and he didn't quite know how to handle this matter. He had nothing against the Icelander except that he was the son of a priest. He didn't want it to be said of Margaret's children that they bore the taint of both parents' birth. Otherwise, Klung was a likable man, good-humored, clever, and very learned. His father, Sira Ara, had raised him himself and taught him well. He had hoped his son would become a priest, and had even taken steps to obtain dispensation for him. But then Klung refused to take the vows. It seemed as if Erlend intended to leave the matter unsettled. If no better match presented itself, then he could always give the maiden to Klung Arason. And yet Erlend had already had such a good offer for his daughter that there was a great deal of talk about his arrogance and imprudence when he allowed that match to slip away. It was the grandson of Baron Sigvat of Lerhulla. Sigmund Finnsson was his name. He wasn't wealthy, because Finn Sigvatsson had had 11 surviving children. Nor was he altogether young. He was about the same age as Erlend, but a respected and sensible man. And yet Margaret would have been wealthy enough because of the properties Erlend had given her when he married Kristin Lavran's daughter, along with all the jewelry and costly possessions he had given the child over the years, as well as the dowry he had agreed upon with Sigmund. Erlend had also been overjoyed to have such a suitor for his daughter born of adultery, but when he came home and told Margaret about this bridegroom, the maiden protested that she wouldn't have him because Sigmund had several warts on one of his eyelids, and she claimed this made her feel such revulsion for him. Erlend bowed to her wishes. When Sigmund became indignant and began talking of a breach of agreement, Erlend responded angrily and told the man that he should realize all agreements were made on the condition that the maiden was willing. His daughter would not be forced into a bridal bed. Kristen agreed with her husband on this matter. He shouldn't force the girl. But she thought Erlend ought to have had a serious discussion with his daughter, and made her realize that Sigmund Finnsson was such a good match that Margaret couldn't possibly expect to find any better, considering her birth. But Erlend grew terribly angry with his wife simply because she had dared to broach the subject with him. All of this Simon had heard about at Ranheim. There they predicted that things could not possibly end well. Erlend might be a powerful man now, and the maiden was certainly lovely. But it had done her no good for her father to spoil her and encourage her stubbornness and arrogance for all these years. After the Frosta Ting, Erlend went home to Husaby with his wife, children, and Simon Dara, who now had his sister's son, Jarvald Jarvaldsson, with him. He was afraid that the reunion, which Sigrid had been yearning for with inexpressible joy, would not turn out well. Sigrid now lived at Kruka in good circumstances. She had 3 handsome children with her husband, and Germund was as good a man as could be found on this earth. He was the one who had spoken to his brother-in-law about bringing Yavald south so that Sigrid might see him, for the child was always on her mind. But Yavald had grown accustomed to living with his grandparents, and the old couple loved the child beyond measure, giving him everything he wanted and humoring his every whim. And things were not the same at Kruka as at Ranheim. Nor was it to be expected that Geirmund would be pleased to have his wife's bastard son come visiting and then behave like a royal child, even bringing along his own servant, an elderly man whom the boy ruled and tyrannized. The man didn't dare say a word against any of Yavald's unreasonable demands. But for Erland's sons, it was cause for celebration when Yavald came to Husaby. Erland didn't think his sons should have any less than the grandson of Arne Yavaldsson did, and so Nokva and Björgulf were given all the things they told him the boy possessed. Now that Erland's oldest sons were big enough to accompany him and go out riding with him, he paid more attention to the boys. Simon noticed that Kristin wasn't entirely pleased by this. She thought that what they learned among his men was not all good. And it was usually about the children that unkind words most often erupted between the couple. Even though they might not have an outright quarrel, they were much closer to it than Simon thought was proper. And it seemed to him that Kristin was most to blame. Erland could be quick-tempered, but she often spoke as if she harbored a deep, hidden rancor toward him. That was the case one day when Kristin brought up several complaints about Nokva. Erland replied that he would have a serious talk with the boy. But after another remark from his wife, he exclaimed angrily that he wasn't about to give the boy a beating in front of the servants. "No, it's too late for that now. If you had done it when he was younger, he would listen to you now. But back then you never paid the slightest attention to him." "Oh yes, I did. But surely it was reasonable that I left him in your keeping when he was small. And besides, it's no job for a man to hand out beatings to little boys who aren't even in breeches yet." "That's not what you thought last week," said Kristin, her voice scornful and bitter. Erland didn't reply but stood up and left the room. And Simon thought it was unkind of his wife to speak to him in this manner. Kristin was referring to something that had happened the week before. Erland and Simon had come riding into the courtyard when little Lavrans ran toward them with a wooden sword in his hand. As he raced past his father's horse, he rashly struck the animal across the leg with his sword. The horse reared up, and the boy was suddenly lying under its feet. Erland backed away, yanked the horse to the side, and threw his reins to Simon. His face was white with dread as he lifted the child up in his arms. But when he saw that the boy was unharmed, he put him over his arm, took the wooden sword, and gave Lavrans a beating on his bare bottom. The boy was not yet wearing breeches. In those first heated moments, he didn't realize how hard he was striking, and Lavrans was still walking around with black and blue marks. But afterwards, Erland tried all day to make amends with the boy, who sulked and clung to his mother, hitting and threatening his father. Later that evening, when Lavrans was settled in his parents' bed where he usually slept, because his mother still nursed him during the night, Erland sat next to him for hours. Every once in a while he would stroke the sleeping child a bit as he gazed down at him. He told Simon that this was the boy he loved most of all his sons. When Erland set off for the summer tings, Simon headed home. He raced south along Galdal, making the sparks fly from his horse's hooves. Once, as they rode more slowly up several steep slopes, his men laughingly asked him whether he was trying to cover 3 days' journey in two. Simon laughed in reply and said that was indeed his intention, "because I'm longing to reach Formo." That was how he always felt whenever he had been away from his estate for long. He loved his home and always felt great joy when he could turn his horse homeward. But this time it seemed he had never longed so much to return to his valley and manor and his young daughters. Yes, he even yearned for Romborg. To be truthful, he thought it unreasonable to feel this way. But up there at Husaby, He had been so uneasy that now he thought he knew firsthand how cattle could sense in their bodies that a storm was brewing. Chapter 2. All summer long, Kristen thought of little else but what Simon had told her about her mother's death. Ronfrid Ivar's daughter had died alone. No one had been near as she drew her last breath, except a servant woman who was asleep. And it helped very little that Simon had said she was well prepared for her death. It was like the providence of God that several days earlier, Ronfrid had felt such a longing for the body of the Savior that she made her confession and was given communion by the priest of the cloister, who was her confessor. It was true that she had been granted a good death. Simon saw her body and said he thought it a wondrous sight. She had grown so beautiful in death. She was a woman of nearly 60, and for many years her face had been greatly lined and wrinkled, and yet now it was completely changed. Her face was youthful and smooth, and she looked just like a young woman asleep. She had been laid to rest at her husband's side. There they had also brought Ulvild Lavran's daughter's remains shortly after her father's death. On top of the graves, a large slab of stone had been placed, divided in two by a beautifully carved cross. On a winding banner, a long Latin verse had been written, composed by the prior of the cloister, but Simon couldn't remember it properly, for he understood little of that language. Ronfrid had lived in her own house on the estate in town, where the Corodians of the cloister resided. She had a small room with a lovely loft room above. There she lived alone with a poor peasant woman who had taken lodgings with the brothers in return for a small payment, provided she would lend a hand to one of the wealthier women lodgers. But during the past half year, it had been Ronfrid who had served the other woman, because the widow, whose name was Torguna, had been unwell. Ronfrid tended to her with great love and kindness. On the last evening of her life, she had attended evensong in the cloister church, and afterwards she went into the cookhouse of the estate. She made a hearty soup with several restorative herbs and told the other women there that she was going to give the soup to Torguna. She hoped the woman would feel well enough the next day so that they could both attend matins. That was the last time anyone saw the widow of Urengard alive. Neither she nor the peasant woman came to matins or to the next service. When some of the monks in the choir noticed that Ronfrid didn't come to the morning mass either, they were greatly surprised. She had never before missed three services in a day. They sent word to town, asking whether the widow of Lavrans Björgulfsson was ill. When servants went up to the loft, they found the soup bowl standing untouched on the table. In the bed, Torguna was sleeping sweetly against the wall. But Ronfrid Ivar's daughter lay on the edge with her hands crossed over her breast, dead and already nearly cold. Simon and Romborg went to her funeral, which was very beautiful. Now that there were so many people in the Husaby household, and Kristen had six sons, she could no longer manage to take part in all the individual chores that had to be done. She had to have a housekeeper to assist her. The mistress of the manor would usually sit in the hall with her sewing. There was always someone who needed clothing, Erlan, Margaret, or one of the boys. The last time she had seen her mother, Ronfrid was riding behind her husband's bier on that bright spring day while she herself stood in the meadow outside Urengard and watched her father's funeral procession setting off across the green carpet of winter rye beneath the hillside scree. Kristen's needle flew in and out as she thought about her parents and their home at Urengard. Now that everything had become memories, she seemed to see so much that she hadn't noticed when she was in the midst of it all. When she took for granted her father's tenderness and protection, as well as the steady, quiet care and toil of her silent, melancholy mother. She thought about her own children. She loved them more than the blood of her own heart, and there was not a waking hour when she wasn't thinking about them. And yet there was much in her soul that she brooded over more. Her children she could love without brooding. While she lived at Uhrengard, she had never thought otherwise than that her parents' whole life and everything they did was for the sake of her and her sisters. Now she seemed to realize that great currents of both sorrow and joy had flowed between these two people, who had been given to each other in their youth by their fathers without being asked. And she knew nothing of this, except that they had departed from her life together. Now she understood that the lives of these two people had contained much more than love for their children. And yet that love had been strong and wide and unfathomably deep, while the love she gave them in return was weak and thoughtless and selfish, even back in her childhood when her parents were her whole world. She seemed to see herself standing far, far away, so small at that distance of time and place. She was standing in the flood of sunlight streaming in through the smoke vent in the old hearth house back home, the winter house of her childhood. Her parents were standing back in the shadows, and they seemed to tower over her as tall as they had been when she was small. They were smiling at her in the way she now knew one smiles at a little child who comes and pushes aside dark and burdensome thoughts. "I thought, Kristen, that once you had children of your own, then you would better understand." She remembered when her mother said those words. Sorrowfully, the daughter thought that she still didn't understand her mother. But now she was beginning to realize how much she didn't understand. That fall, Archbishop Eilif died. At about the same time, King Magnus had the terms changed for many of the sheriffs in the land, but not for Erland Nikolausson. When he was in Björgvin during the last summer before the king came of age, Erland had received a letter stating that he should be granted 1/4 of the income collected from bail paid by criminals, from fines for the crime of letter breaching, and from forfeitures of property. There had been much talk about his acquisition of such rights toward the end of a regency. Erland had a vast income because he now owned a great deal of land in the county and usually stayed on his own estates when he traveled around his district, but he permitted his leaseholders to buy their way out of their obligation to house and feed him. It's true that he took in little in land taxes, and the upkeep of his manor was costly. In addition to his household servants, he never had fewer than 12 armed men with him at Husaby. They rode the best horses and were splendidly outfitted, and whenever Erland traveled around his district, his men lived like noblemen. This matter was mentioned one day when Judge Harald and the sheriff of Gauderla County were visiting Husaby. Erland replied that many of these men had been with him when he lived up north. "Back then we shared whatever conditions we found there, eating dried fish and drinking bitter ale. Now these men whom I clothe and feed know that I won't begrudge them white bread and foreign ale. And if I tell them to go to hell when I get angry, they know that I don't mean for them to set off on the journey without me in the lead." Ulf Haldorsson, who was now the head of Erland's men, later told Kristen that this was true. Erland's men loved him, and he had complete command of them. "You know yourself, Kristen, that no one should rely too heavily on what Erland says. He must be judged by what he does." It was also rumored that in addition to his household servants, Erland had men throughout the countryside, even outside Orkdarla County, who had sworn allegiance to him on the hilt of his sword. Finally, a letter from the crown arrived regarding this matter, but Erland replied that these men had been part of his ship's crew, and they had been bound to him by oath ever since that first spring when he sailed north. He was then commanded to release the men at the next ting he held to announce the verdicts and decisions of the law ting, and he was to summon to the meeting those men who lived outside the county and pay for their journey himself. He did summon some of his old crew members from outside Mura to the ting at Orkadal, but no one heard that he released them or any other men who had served him in his position as chieftain. For the time being, the matter was allowed to languish, and as the autumn wore on, people stopped talking about it altogether. Late that fall, Erland journeyed south and spent Christmas at the court of King Magnus, who was residing in Oslo that year. Erland was annoyed that he couldn't persuade his wife to come with him, but Kristin had no courage for the difficult winter journey, and she stayed at Huseby. Erland returned home 3 weeks after Christmas, bringing splendid gifts for his wife and all his children. He gave Kristin a silver bell so she could ring for her maids. To Margaret, he gave a clasp of solid gold, which was something she didn't yet own, although she had all sorts of silver and gilded jewelry. But when the women were putting away these costly gifts in their jewelry chests, something got caught on Margaret's sleeve. The girl quickly removed it and hid it in her hand as she said to her stepmother, "This belonged to my mother. That's why Father doesn't want me to show it to you." But Kristen's face had turned even more crimson than the maiden's. Her heart pounded with fear, but she knew that she had to speak to the young girl and warn her. After a moment, she said in a quiet and uncertain voice, "That looks like the gold clasp that Fru Helga of Gimsar used to wear to banquets." "Well, many gold things look much the same," replied the maiden curtly. Kristen locked her chest and stood with her hands resting on top so that Margaret wouldn't see how they were shaking. "Dear Margaret," she said softly and gently, but then she had to stop while she gathered all her strength. "Dear Margaret, I have often bitterly regretted. My happiness has never been complete, even though my father forgave me with all his heart for the sorrows I caused him. You know that I sinned greatly against my parents for the sake of your father. But the longer I live, and the more I come to understand, the harder it is for me to remember that I rewarded their kindness by causing them sorrow. Dear Margaret, your father has been good to you all your days." "You don't have to worry, Mother," replied the girl. "I'm not your lawful daughter. You don't have to worry that I might put on your filthy shift or step into your shoes." Her eyes flashing with anger, Kristen turned to face her stepdaughter. But then she gripped the cross she wore around her neck tightly in her hand and bit back the words she was about to speak. She took this matter to Sira Eiliv that very evening after Vespers, and she looked in vain for some sign in the priest's face. Had a misfortune already occurred, and did he know about it? She thought about her own misguided youth. She remembered Sira Eirik's face, which gave nothing away as he lived side by side with her and her trusting parents, with her sinful secret locked inside his heart, while she remained mute and callous to his stern entreaties and admonitions. And she remembered when she showed her own mother gifts that Erland had given her in Oslo. That was after she had been lawfully betrothed to him. Her mother's expression was steady and calm as she picked up the items, one by one, looked at them, praised them, and then laid them aside. Kristen was deathly afraid and anguished, and she kept a vigilant eye on Margaret. Erland noticed that something was troubling his wife, and one evening after they had gone to bed, he asked whether she might be with child again. Kristen lay in silence for a moment before she replied that she thought she was. And when her husband lovingly took her in his arms without another word, she didn't have the heart to tell him that something else was causing her sorrow. But when Erland whispered to her that this time she must try and give him a daughter, she couldn't manage a reply but lay there, rigid with fear, thinking that Erland would find out soon enough what kind of joy a man had from his daughters. Several nights later, everyone at Huseby had gone to bed slightly drunk and with their stomachs quite full, because it was the last few days before Lent began. For this reason, they all slept heavily. Late that night, little Lavrans woke up in his parents' bed, crying and demanding sleepily to nurse at his mother's breast, but they were trying to wean him. Erland woke up, grunting crossly. He picked up the boy, gave him some milk from a cup that stood on the step of the bed, and then lay the child back down on the other side of him. Kristen had fallen into a deep slumber again when she suddenly realized that Erland was sitting up in bed. Only half awake, she asked what was wrong. He hushed her in a voice that she didn't recognize. Soundlessly, he slipped out of bed, and she saw that he was pulling on a few clothes. When she propped herself up on one elbow, he pressed her back against the pillows with one hand as he bent over her and took down his sword, which hung over the headboard. He moved as quietly as a lynx, but she saw that he was going over to the ladder which led up to Margaret's chamber above the entry hall. For a moment, Kristen lay in bed completely paralyzed with fear. Then she sat up, found her shift and gown, and began hunting for her shoes on the floor beside the bed. Suddenly, a woman's scream rang out from the loft, loud enough to be heard all over the estate. Erlan's voice shouted a word or two, and then Kristen heard the clang of swords striking each other and the stomp of feet overhead. Then the sound of a weapon falling to the floor and Margaret screaming in terror. Kristen was on her knees, huddled next to the hearth. She scraped away the hot ashes with her bare hands and blew on the embers. When she had lit a torch and lifted it up with trembling hands, she saw Erland in the darkness above. He leaped down from the loft, not bothering with the ladder, holding his drawn sword in his hand, and then dashed out the main door. The boys were peering out from the dark on all sides of the room. Kristen went over to the enclosed bed on the north wall, where the three eldest slept, and told them to lie down and shut the door. Ivar and Skúla were sitting on the bench, blinking at the light, frightened and bewildered. She told them to climb up into her bed, and then she shut them inside too. Then she lit a candle and went out into the courtyard. It was raining. For a moment, as the light of her candle was reflected in the glistening, ice-covered ground, she saw a crowd standing outside the door to the next building, the servants' hall where Erland's men slept. Then the flame of her candle was blown out, and for a moment the night was pitch dark. But then a lantern emerged from the servants' hall, and Ulf Haldorsson was carrying it. He bent down over a dark body curled up on the wet patches of ice. Kristen knelt down and touched the man. It was young Håkon of Gimsar, and he was either senseless or dead. Her hands were at once covered with blood. With Ulf's help, she straightened out his body and turned him over. The blood was gushing out of his right arm, where his hand had been lopped off. Involuntarily, Kristen glanced at the window hatch of Margaret's chamber as it slammed shut in the wind. She couldn't discern any face up there, but it was quite dark. As she knelt in the rain puddles, clamping her hand as tight as she could around Håkon's wrist to stop the spurting blood, she was aware of Erland's men standing half-dressed all around her. Then she noticed Erland's gray, contorted face. With a corner of his tunic, he wiped off his bloody sword. He was naked underneath, and his feet were bare. "One of you, find me something to bind this with. And you, Bjorn, go and wake up Sira Eilev. We'll carry him over to the parsonage." She took the leather strap that they gave her and wrapped it around the stump of the man's arm. Suddenly Erland said, his voice harsh and wild, "Nobody touch him. Let the man lie where he fell."
"You must realize, husband, we can't do that," said Kristen calmly, although her heart was pounding so loud that she thought she would suffocate.
Erland rammed the tip of his sword hard against the ground. "Yes, she's not your flesh and blood. You've made that quite clear to me every single day for all these years."
Kristen stood up and whispered quietly to him, "And yet for her sake, I want this to be concealed, if it can be done. You men," she turned to the servants who were standing around them, "if you're loyal to your master, you won't speak of this until he has told you how this quarrel with Håkon arose." All the men agreed. One of them dared step forward and explained. They had been awakened by the sound of a woman screaming, as if she were being taken by force. And then someone ran along their roof, but he must have slipped on the icy surface. They heard a scrambling noise and then a thud on the ground. But Kristen told the man to be silent. At that moment, Sira Eilev came running. When Erland turned on his heel and went inside,
His wife ran after him and tried to force her way past him. When he headed for the ladder to the loft, she sprang in front of him and grabbed him by the arm.
Erlon, what will you do to the child?
She gasped, looking up into his wild gray face. Without replying, he tried to fling her aside, but she held on tight.
Wait, Erlon, wait. Your child. You don't know. The man was fully clothed,
she cried urgently. He gave a loud wail before he answered. She turned as pale as a corpse with horror. His words were so raw and his voice unrecognizable with desperate anguish. Then she wrestled mutely with the raging man. He snarled and gnashed his teeth until she managed to catch his eye in the dim light.
Erlon, let me go to her first. I haven't forgotten the day when I was no better than Margaret.
Then he released her and staggered backwards against the wall to the next room. He stood there, shaking like a dying beast. Kristen went to light a candle, then came back and went past him up to Margaret in her bedchamber. The first thing the candlelight fell on was a sword lying on the floor not far from the bed, and a severed hand beside it. Kristen tore off the wimple which she, without thinking, had wrapped loosely over her flowing hair before she went out to the men in the courtyard. Now she dropped it over the hand lying on the floor. Margaret was huddled up on the pillows at the headboard, staring at Kristen's candle, wide-eyed and terrified. She was clutching the bedclothes around her, but her white shoulders shone naked under her golden curls. There was blood all over the room. The strain in Kristen's body erupted into violent sobs. It was such a terrible sight to see that fair young child amidst such horror. Then Margaret screamed loudly,
"Mother, what will Father do to me?"
Kristen couldn't help it. In spite of her deep sympathy for the girl, her heart seemed to shrink and harden in her breast. Margaret didn't ask what her father had done to Håkon. For an instant she saw Erland lying on the ground, and her own father standing over him with the bloody sword, and she herself. But Margaret hadn't budged. Kristen couldn't stem her old feeling of scornful displeasure toward Elina's daughter as Margaret threw herself against her, trembling and almost senseless with fear. She sat down on the bed and tried to soothe the child. That was how Erland found them when he appeared on the ladder. He was now fully dressed. Margaret began screaming again and hid her face in her stepmother's arms. Kristen glanced up at her husband for a moment. He was calm now, but his face was pale and strange. For the first time, he looked his age. But she obeyed him when he said calmly, "You must go downstairs now, Kristen. I want to speak to my daughter alone." Gently she laid the girl down on the bed, pulled the covers up to her chin, and went down the ladder. She did as Erland had done and got properly dressed. There would be no more sleep at Husaby that night. And then she set about reassuring the frightened children and servants. The next morning, in a snowstorm, Margaret's maid left the manor in tears, carrying her possessions in a sack on her back. The master had chased her out with the harshest words, threatening to flay her bloody because she had sold her mistress in such a fashion. Then Erland interrogated the other servants. Hadn't any of the maids suspected anything when all autumn and winter Ingalive kept coming to sleep with them instead of Margaret in her chamber? And the dogs had been locked up with them too. But all of them denied it, which was only to be expected. Finally, he took his wife aside to speak to her alone. Sick at heart and deathly tired, Kristen listened to him and tried to counter his injustice with meek replies. She didn't deny that she had been worried, but she didn't tell him that she had never spoken to him of her fears, because she received nothing but ingratitude every time she attempted to counsel him or Margaret about the maiden's best interests. And she swore by God and the Virgin Mary that she had never realized or even imagined that this man might come to Margaret up in the loft at night.
"You," said Erland scornfully, "you said yourself that you remember the time when you were no better than Margaret, And the Lord God in heaven knows that every day, in all these years we've lived together, you've made certain I would see how you remember the injustice I did to you. Even though your desire was as keen as mine. And it was your father, not I, who caused much of the unhappiness when he refused to give you to me as my wife. I was willing enough to rectify the sin from the very outset, when you saw the Gimzar gold. He grabbed his wife's hand and held it up. The two rings glittered which Erland had given her while they were together at Gerderud. Didn't you know what it meant? When all these years you've worn the rings I gave you after you let me take your honor? Kristen was faint with weariness and sorrow. She whispered,
I wonder, Erland, whether you even remember that time when you won my honor.
Then he covered his face with his hands and flung himself down on the bench, his body writhing and convulsing. Kristen sat down some distance away. She wished she could help her husband. She realized that this misfortune was even harder for him to bear because he himself had sinned against others in the same way as they had now sinned against him. And he, who had never wanted to take the blame for any trouble he might have caused, couldn't possibly bear the blame for this unhappiness. And there was no one else but her for him to fault. But she wasn't angry as much as she was sad and afraid of what might happen next. Every once in a while, she would go up to see to Margaret. The girl lay in bed, motionless and pale and staring straight ahead. She had still not asked about Hawkins' fate. Kristen didn't know if this was because she didn't dare or because she had grown numb from her own misery. That afternoon, Kristen saw Erlan and Klong the Icelander walking together through the snowdrifts over to the armory. But only a short time later, Erlan returned alone. Kristen glanced up for a moment when he came into the light and walked past her, but then she didn't dare turn her gaze toward the corner of the room where he had retreated. She had seen that he was a broken man. Later, when she went over to the storeroom to get something, Ivar and Skúla came running to tell their mother that Klong the Icelander was going to leave that evening. The boys were sad because the scribe was their good friend. He was packing up his things right now. He wanted to reach Bjergsey by nightfall. Kristen could guess what had happened. Erland had offered his daughter to the scribe, but he didn't want a maiden who had been seduced. What this conversation must have been like for Erland. She felt dizzy and ill and refused to think any more about it. The following day a message came from the parsonage. Håkon Eindridsson wanted to speak to Erland. Erland sent back a reply that he had nothing more to say to Håkon. Sarah Eilif told Kristen that if Håkon lived, he would be greatly crippled. In addition to losing his hand, he had also gravely injured his back and hips when he fell from the roof of the servants' hall. But he wanted to go home, even in this condition, and the priest had promised to find a sleigh for him. Håkon now regretted his sin with all his heart. He said that the actions of Margaret's father were fully justified, no matter what the law might say. But he hoped that everyone would do their best to hush up the incident, so that his guilt and Margaret's shame might be concealed as much as possible. That afternoon he was carried out to the sleigh, which Sarah Eilif had borrowed at Repstad, and the priest rode with him to Galdal. The next day, which was Ash Wednesday, the people of Husaby had to go to the parish church at Vinjar, but at Vespers Kristen asked the curate to let her into the church at Husaby. She could still feel the ashes on her head as she knelt beside her stepson's grave and said the Paternoster for his soul. By now there was probably not much left of the boy but bones beneath the stone. Bones and hair and a scrap of the clothing he had been laid to rest in. She had seen the remains of her little sister when they dug up her grave to take her body to her father in Hamar. Dust and ashes. She thought about her father's handsome features, about her mother's big eyes and her lined face, and Ronfrid's figure which continued to look strangely young and delicate and light, even though her face seemed old so early. Now they lay under a stone, falling apart like buildings that collapse when the people have moved away. Images swirled before her eyes, the charred remains of the church back home, and a farm at Silsadal, which they rode past on their way to Voga. The buildings were deserted and caving in. The people who worked the fields didn't dare go near after the sun went down. She thought about her own beloved dead, their faces and voices, their smiles and habits and demeanor. Now that they had departed for that other land, it was painful to think about their figures. It was like remembering your home when you knew it was standing there deserted, with the rotting beams sinking into the earth. She sat on the bench along the wall of the empty church. The old smell of cold incense kept her thoughts fixed on images of death and the decay of temporal things. And she didn't have the strength to lift up her soul to catch a glimpse of the land where they were, the place to which all goodness and love and faith had finally been moved and now endured. Each day, when she prayed for the peace of their souls, it seemed to her unfair that she should pray for those who had possessed more peace in their souls here on earth than she had ever known since she became a grown woman. Sira Iliv would no doubt say that prayers for the dead were always good. Good for oneself, since the other person had already found peace with God. But this did not help her. It seemed to her that when her weary body was finally rotting beneath a gravestone, her restless soul would still be hovering around somewhere nearby, the way a lost spirit wanders, moaning, through the ruined buildings of an abandoned farm. For in her soul, sin continued to exist, like the roots of a weed intertwined in the soil. It no longer blossomed or flared up or smelled fragrant, but it was still there in the soil, pale and strong and alive. In spite of all the tenderness that welled up inside her when she saw her husband's despair, she didn't have the will to silence the inner voice that asked, hurt and embittered, "How can you speak that way to me? Have you forgotten when I gave you my faith and my honor? Have you forgotten when I was your beloved friend?" And yet she understood that as long as this voice spoke within her, she would continue to speak to him as if she had forgotten. In her thoughts, she threw herself down before St. Olav's shrine. She reached for Brother Edvin's moldering bones over in the church at Vatsfield. She held in her hands the reliquaries containing the tiny remnants of a dead woman's shroud and the splinters of bone from an unknown martyr. She reached for protection to the small scraps which, through death and decay, had preserved a little of the power of the departed soul, like the magical powers residing in the rusted swords taken from the burial mounds of ancient warriors. On the following day, rode to Nidaros with only Ulf and one servant to accompany him. He didn't return to Husaby during all of Lent, but Ulf came to get his armed men and then left to meet him at the Mid-Lenten Ting in Orkadal. Ulf drew Kristen aside to tell her that he had arranged with T. Decken Paus, the German goldsmith in Nidaros, for Margaret to marry his son Gerlach just after Easter. Erland came home for the holy day. He was quite calm and composed now, but Kristen thought she could tell that he would never recover from this misfortune the way he had recovered from so much else. Perhaps this was because he was no longer young, or because nothing had ever humiliated him so deeply. Margaret seemed indifferent to the arrangements her father had made on her behalf. One evening, when Erland and Kristen were alone, he said, "If she had been my lawful child, or her mother had been an unmarried woman, I would never have given her to a stranger, as things now stand with her. I would have granted shelter and protection to both her and any child of hers. That's the worst of it. But because of her birth, a lawful husband can offer her the best protection." As Kristen made all the preparations for the departure of her stepdaughter, Erland said one day in a brusque voice, "I don't suppose you're well enough to travel to town with us."
"If that's what you wish, I will certainly go with you," said Kristen.
"Why should I wish it? You've never taken a mother's place for her before, and you don't need to do so now. It's not going to be a festive wedding.
and Fru Gunna of Roswald and her son's wife have promised to come, for the sake of kinship.
And so Kristin stayed at Husaby, while Erland was in Nidaros, to give his daughter to Gerlach T. Dickinson.
Chapter 3. That summer, just before St. John's Day, Gunulf Nikolausen returned to his monastery. Erland was in town during the Frosta Ting. He sent a message home, asking his wife whether she would care to come to Nidaros to see her brother-in-law. Kristin wasn't feeling very well, but she went all the same. When she met Erland, he told her that his brother's health seemed completely broken. The friars hadn't had much success with their endeavors up north at Munkafjord. They never managed to have the church they had built consecrated, because the archbishop couldn't travel north during a time of such unrest. Finally, they ended up with no bread or wine, candles or oil for the services. But when Brother Gunulf and Brother Aslak sailed for Vágr for supplies, the Finns cast their spells and the ship sank. They were stranded on a skerry for 3 days, and afterwards neither of them regained his full health. Brother Aslak died a short time later. They had suffered terribly from scurvy during Lent, for they had no flour or herbs to eat along with the dried fish. Then Bishop Håkon of Bjørgvin and Master Arne, who was in charge of the cathedral chapter while Lord Paul was at the Curia to be ordained as archbishop, instructed the monks who were still alive to return home. The priests at Vágr were to tend to the flocks at Munkafjord for the time being. Although she was not unprepared, Kristin was still shocked when she saw Gunulf Nikolausen again. She went with Erland over to the monastery the next day, and they were escorted into the interview room. The monk came in. His body was bent over, his fringe of hair was now completely gray, and the skin under his sunken eyes was wrinkled and dark brown. But his smooth, pale complexion was flecked with leaden-colored spots, and she noticed that his hand was covered with the same spots when he thrust it out from the sleeve of his robe to take her hand. He smiled, and she saw that he had lost several teeth. They sat down and talked for a while, but it seemed as if Gunulf had also forgotten how to speak. He mentioned this himself before they left. "But you, Erlen, you are just the same. You don't seem to have aged at all," he said with a little smile. Kristin knew that she looked miserable at the moment, while Erland was so handsome as he stood there, tall and slender and dark and well-dressed. And yet Kristin knew in her heart that he too had been greatly changed. It was odd that Gunulf couldn't see it. He had always been so sharp-sighted in the past. One day late in the summer, Kristin was up in the clothing loft, and Fru Gunna of Roswald was with her. She had come to Husaby to help Kristin when she once again gave birth. They could hear Nokva and Bjørgulf singing down in the courtyard as they sharpened their knives, a lewd and vulgar ballad which they sang at the top of their lungs. Their mother was beside herself with rage as she went downstairs to speak to her sons in the harshest words. She wanted to know who had taught the boys the song. It must have been in the servants' hall, but who among the men would teach children such a song? The boys refused to answer. Then Skúla appeared beneath the loft steps. He told his mother she might as well stop asking, because they had learned the ballad from listening to their father sing it. Fru Gunna joined in. Had they no fear of God that they would sing such a song? Especially now that they couldn't be sure, when they went to bed at night, whether they might be motherless before the roosters crowed. Kristin didn't reply but went quietly back into the house. Later, after she had taken to her bed to rest, Nokva came into the room to see her. He took his mother's hand but did not speak, and then he began to weep softly. She talked to him gently, jesting and begging him not to grieve or cry. She had made it through 6 times before. Surely she would make it through the 7th. But the boy wept harder and harder. Finally, she allowed him to crawl into the bed between her and the wall, and there he lay, sobbing, with his arms around her neck and his head pressed to his mother's breast. But she couldn't get him to tell her what he was crying about, even though he stayed with her until the servants began carrying in the evening meal. Nokva was now 12 years old. He was big for his age and tried to affect a manly and grown-up bearing, but he had a gentle soul, and his mother could sometimes see that he was very childish. But he was old enough to understand the misfortune that had befallen his half-sister. Kristen wondered whether he could also see that his father was different afterwards. Erland had always been the kind of man who could say the worst things when his temper was aroused. But in the past, he had never said an unkind word to anyone except in anger. And he had been quick to make amends when his own good humor was restored. Nowadays, he could say harsh and ugly things with a cold expression on his face. Before, he used to curse and swear fiercely. But to some extent, he had put aside this bad habit when he saw that it bothered his wife and offended Sira Iliv, for whom he had gradually developed great respect. But he had never been rude or spoken in a vulgar manner, and he had never approved when other men talked that way. In that sense, he was much more modest than many a man who had lived a purer life. As much as it offended Kristen to hear such a song on the lips of her innocent sons, especially in her present condition, and then to hear they had learned it from their father, there was something else that gave her an even more bitter taste in her mouth. She realized that Erland was still childish enough to think that he could counter cruelty with cruelty since, after suffering the shame of his daughter, he had now begun to use foul words and speak in an offensive manner. Fru Gunna had told her that Margaret had given birth to a stillborn son shortly before St. Olaf's Day. She also knew that Margaret already seemed to have found ample consolation. She got on well with Gerlach, and he was kind to her. Erland went to see his daughter whenever he was in Nidaros, and Gerlach always made a great fuss over his father-in-law, although Erland was not particularly willing to accept this man as his kinsman. But Erland had not once mentioned his daughter at Husaby since she had left the manor. Kristen gave birth to another son. He was baptized Munan, after Erland's grandfather. During the time she lay in the little house, Nokva came to see his mother daily, bringing her berries and nuts he had picked in the woods, or wreaths he had woven from medicinal herbs. Erland returned home when the new child was 3 weeks old. He often sat with his wife and tried to be gentle and loving. And this time he didn't complain that the infant was not a maiden or that the boy was weak and frail. But Kristen said very little in response to his warm words. She was silent and pensive and despondent. And this time she was slow to recover her health. All winter long Kristen was ailing, and it seemed unlikely that the child would survive. The mother had little thought for anything but the poor infant. For this reason, she listened with only half an ear to all the talk of the great news that was heard that winter. King Magnus had fallen into the worst financial straits through his attempts to win sovereignty over Skåne, and he had demanded assistance and taxes from Norway. Some of the noblemen of the council seemed willing enough to support him in this matter. But when the king's envoys came to Tunsberg, the royal treasurer was away, and Stig Håkonsson, who was the chieftain of the Tunsberg fortress, barred the king's men from entering and made ready to defend the stronghold with force. He had few men of his own, but Erling Vidkunsson, who was his uncle through marriage and was at home on his estate at Aker, sent 40 armed men to the fortress while he himself sailed west. At about the same time, the king's cousins, Jon and Sigurd Hofterson, threatened to oppose the king because of a court ruling that had gone against some of their men. Erland laughed at all this and said the Hoftersons had shown their youth and stupidity in this matter. Discontent with King Magnus was not rampant in Norway. The noblemen were demanding that a regent be placed in charge of the kingdom and that the royal seal be given to a Norwegian man for safekeeping, since the king, because of his dealings in Skåne, seemed to want to spend most of his time in Sweden.
The townsmen and the clergy of the towns had become frightened by rumors of the king's loans from the German city-states. The insolence of the Germans and their disregard for Norwegian laws and customs were already more than could be tolerated. And now it was said that the king had promised them even greater rights and freedoms in Norwegian towns.